Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Aparutate sangha buddhassa dwara yeso tavanto pumchantu sadhante. So, for those of you who didn't catch it before, my name is Bhante Sujato, and some of you may recognize me from being around the Buddhist Society. I first came here, it was in 1997. So, anyone here been around the Buddhist Society since 1997, earlier? Anyone? Lynn's been here. Good. I'm around long before then. So it's been, an important part of my life to this community and these people and Ajahn Brahman and his work and all of you. So it's very nice for me to be back here. And a lot of people have noticed that I've been fairly absent for the past couple of years. So and then they ask me, where have you been and what are you doing? So I might talk a little bit about what I've been doing for the last couple of years. Actually, I find it difficult to talk about because it's mostly pretty boring. But anyway, I'll do my best to liven it up. But essentially what I've been doing for the last couple of years is translating Pali suttas. When I say it's been fairly boring, I mean it's been fairly boring on kind of external level because I've really just doing translations, nothing much else has been happening. So for me, it's very much a labour of love and something that I, just love doing. And so what I might try to do is to try to share with you some of my, some of the process and some of the my feelings about what I've been doing and why I was doing it. So like many of you, I first encountered Buddhism through meditation. And I went to a meditation center in Thailand, Wat Rampong, and did an intensive meditation session there. And they do these really super hardcore retreats. Like super hardcore. I don't really recommend it for beginners like myself. It's a bit too hardcore for some people. But anyway, I enjoyed it. I was young and foolish, so I loved it. We did like a 26-day intensive retreat, and at the end of that retreat, you don't sleep for like 4 days. Yeah, they just make you meditate round the clock. Yeah, someone's nodding here. Has he been there? Yeah, he's been there. He knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. So some of us make it out the other side, so that's good. Yeah. Anyway, I did this retreat, and that obviously goes without saying that retreat changed my life. And there was like a moment, many profound things happened to me during that retreat. And, many different insights and experiences in meditation and so on. And, but one moment that I always remember, it's just a very, very small moment. It's not a big insight or big meditation attainment or anything like that, but it's just like a thought that came to me one day. And I was sitting after doing my afternoon's meditation. It's just the evening time, and this is in Chiang Mai. It's in the hot season, and if you know Chiang Mai, you know it's very hot in the hot season. And just in that evening time, it's cooling down, and sitting underneath some trees and drinking a cup of tea and just sitting there. And this thought came to me, oh, this is what peace of mind means. I've never known what that meant before. People use this word. What does it mean to have a peaceful mind? This is what people are talking about when they talk about peace of mind. And in that moment, I was just perfectly content. I didn't want to be anywhere else or do anything else, and I was just there, and I was present, and I was clear. And so for me, that was a very small thing, but it's very profound to realize that this thing that we call peace of mind, it is a reality. It's not just a word, and it's a reality that you can experience through your own practice, right? And one of the good things about that retreat was that they didn't really teach you anything, right? I mean, it doesn't feel like a good thing at the time because you really wish a bit more support and guidance and stuff, right? But actually, all they do is tell you how to meditate. And you go in there and blah, 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 and you tell them about all the pain you went through and all of the suffering and all of the things you happened and, oh, no, all so terrible. Oh. And they say, yes, 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 okay, well, just be mindful. Go back. Do it again tomorrow. Okay, thank you so much. And so they really are following that teaching of letting you see for yourself, right? Rather than trying to impose their teachings on you. And this is something, again, this was very radical for me. And I came from a Christian background, brought up as a Catholic. And my experience as a Catholic was fine. You know, I never had any, you know, they were pretty kind of chill Catholics in those days, at least my experience of them was. I wasn't like indoctrinated or anything like that. But it very much was, you know, if you want to learn about our religion, then we're going to teach you, and this is what it is, and this is what we believe, and so on. But here they weren't telling me really anything. It was just some very simple teachings, you know, impermanence and some things like this. But you just see it for yourself. And so when I came from that retreat, you know, I had so much curiosity. I really wanted to learn, right? I really wanted to try to understand what is this experience. I wanted to make sense of it. I knew what the experience felt like, right? But I didn't know how to make sense of it. How do you make it part of your life? And so I went to the teachers and said, you know, can I have some books or something like that? And so they gave me a few Dhamma books to read, and I read them, and I thought they were kind of boring, like my confession, including one of them with an essay by Ajahn Brahm. I won't mention which one. It was okay. I didn't have a problem with it. It was all right. This was one of his very, very early writings, long ago. So please don't judge me or him by that. It was one of the very first things he published. And I read it and I was like, oh, it's okay. But it's just, that's all. It was just like, you know, some nice anecdotes and some nice reflections and things like that. But it didn't mean all that much to me. And so I went back to the teachers and I said, like, where's the real stuff? Right? Where's the good stuff? And they pointed me to the suttas. And so I got a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, translated by Venerable Nyanamoli in those days. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation hadn't come out yet. And so I read that, and as soon as I started reading that, I began to realize, oh, this is actually what the Buddha was teaching. And there was just this immediate sense of connection. Of course, I didn't understand half of it, more than half, I'm sure. But this sense, oh, this is the wellspring, right? This is where all this Dhamma comes from. And you can feel that there's something in there which is like, it's got a rawness to it, it's got a freshness to it. And one of the things that I love about the Buddhist discourses and Buddhist teachings is that it's about the Buddha in connection with people, right? It's not it's not a textbook, right? It's about occasions, it's stories about what happens. And somebody comes to the Buddha and says, I'm sick, what do I do? Right? And then the Buddha teaches them, yeah? Your body is impermanent, and teaches them how to cope with how it teaches that person at that moment with that problem. Yeah? And so the suttas are a living record of the Buddha in his encounters with people and his teachings. And so as I went on in Buddhism and I went on to in practice, then these always were the two main things that inspired me right from the beginning to today. Right? First of all was meditation, and second of all was the suttas. And these two things are the heart of Buddhism and the heart of what everything that I've done since then. So when we're talking about the Buddha suttas and the Buddha scriptures, then of course you know, as part of, if you've been hanging around the Buddhist society, you'll know that like on Sundays we have our sutta classes, and you know that these things have been taught as a regular part of what we do here, and that it's available for you if you want to learn it. Okay? But many of you who maybe come from traditional Buddhist backgrounds would know that this is actually quite unusual, and that in places like Thailand or perhaps Sri Lanka might be a bit of an exception, but in many places in the world there's a lot of Buddhism, but One teacher said to me, put it like this, he'd just come back from a trip to Thailand, and I said, how did you like Thailand? And he said, oh, it was all right. He said it was a bit too much Buddhism. This is what one of the monks said to me, too much Buddhism in Thailand. And I knew exactly what he meant, right? Too much Buddhism and not enough Dharma. Yeah? And so this is how it can be sometimes. So we're all about creating those external signs of Buddhism, you know, like beautiful temples and beautiful pagodas and beautiful Buddha images. And all of those things are lovely, of course, right? But how much Dharma is there? And so, you know, when you're staying here, you have the opportunity to listen to the suttas being explained by the monks and the nuns who've studied them and have some understanding. And but that opportunity is still fairly rare in the world. And you also have the opportunity to listen to teachings by Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahmali, and others whose own practice has been informed by their study and learning of the suttas. And again, this is something that's relatively rare in this world. And so a number of years ago, as part of my sort of journey into Dhamma, I made friends with some scholars, including Rod Bucknell in Queensland and Venerable Analio. And at that time, this was about 2003, 2004, we were starting to look at the Buddha suttas and the relationship between the Buddha suttas in Pali and those in Chinese. And one of the things which was at that time relatively little known, but since that time has become better known, was how closely related many of these scriptures are in Pali and Chinese and so on. Now this might seem like might not seem very important, it might seem just like a historical detail. But for those of us who have an inquiring mind, for those of us who want to try to know what is the facts on the ground, this is something that's of real and crucial importance. Why? Because what it shows is that the Buddha taught in India, he taught in the Ganges Valley, okay, and he lived and died in India and in the Ganges Valley. And I'm sorry, I express my heartfelt apologies to my Sri Lankan friends. No, the Buddha didn't visit Sri Lanka. He didn't visit China, he didn't visit Thailand or Myanmar or any of these places. He lived and died in the Ganges Valley. And Dhamma was taken from there to all of these different places. Taken to Sri Lanka, taken to northwest of India, taken to the east, to Myanmar and to Thailand. And then taken through the trade routes to China, to Japan and so on, and then a little later to Tibet. And so that whole huge region of the world was reached by Buddhist monks, Buddhist travelers, Buddhist nuns within a few hundred years after the Buddha passed away. And they brought with them these Buddhist scriptures. And so for more than 2,000 years, these traditions have been separated. Right? This is where it gets interesting. Right? So one set of scriptures has gone south to Sri Lanka, another one north to China. Yeah? And they've been separated for 2,000 years. And yet when we look at them, they are so very similar. And so this has been one of the great projects of Buddhist scholarship in the last few years and few decades, was to look at these scriptures and to look at what are the similarities and what are the differences. And so of course, yes, there are things that are different. They're not identical in every word. But what we find is that the teachings, the phrases, the sayings of the Buddha, again and again and again, in thousands and thousands and thousands of cases, are the same, no matter if it's the Pali version, the Chinese version, the Sanskrit version, the Tibetan version. And the differences are usually very minor. So what does this tell us? Right? What does this say to us? Well, what this tells us is that the Buddhist traditions were pretty good at preserving the Buddha's teachings. Right? They preserved it for all of that time. And it means that all of those teachings in the different Buddhist traditions come back to that original teaching found in India in the Ganges Valley from around 2,500 BC. Now we can't prove that that's the case, right? If I was a scientist, I would say, well, yes, there are degrees of proof and probability, right? But it's by far the most plausible hypothesis. I mean, what other explanation could there be, right, to have so many similarities in these scriptures which are so far apart? The only explanation to me that actually makes sense from a historical point of view is the obvious one, that these were teachings taught by a great spiritual teacher called the Buddha in India 2,500 years ago and taken and spread out to these different places. And so as modern day practitioners and modern day scholars, I think this is something which is very crucial to our understanding of the Dhamma. And, you know, just think about it and think about so many times that you may have had questions, that you may have had doubts, you might have heard a particular teaching on meditation, somebody says this, another teaching on meditation, somebody says that, and you're like, what do I do? Right? And what do I follow? And teachers of Buddhism in the modern times will disagree with each other frequently. We like to disagree with each other, it's fun, right? And so we will argue different points and have different points of view, and sometimes one might seem reasonable and one might seem not reasonable, but what did the Buddha say? Where do these, how do we know what it is that the Buddha taught? And so that then comes back to the suttas. So in modern times we have these different scriptures which are found all over the world in these different languages, and are lots of them. And so what we did through the website I've been working on, through Sutta Central, is we collated all those, we've compiled several tens of thousands of cases where these scriptures are the same, and we show those relationships between them, we gather the original text and so on, and we try to make them available to people all around the world. And this is a project I've been working on since that time, since about 2003, 2004. But we had one big problem, and the big problem was that we didn't have a really good translation of the core scriptures in Pali into modern English. And the reason for that was largely because of copyright, because translations are held under copyright and they're not freely available. And I think this is a shame. I don't know what you think about it, but I think this is... I don't like that, because, you know, as Buddhists, Dhamma should be for everyone, right? I mean, we don't put a barrier on the door and say, you know, you can come in if you pay us money, and then if you don't pay us money, go away, right? The Buddha never did that. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine the Buddha charging money to listen to his teachings? So the Buddha always gave his teachings away for free. And so I think this is how the Dhamma should be. This is how we, the Buddhist community, have maintained and passed the Dhamma down for 2,500 years. And I believe that that is what we should be still doing today. And so I wanted to be able to convey these teachings of the Buddha in a clear, modern way that people could understand. And so I tried various kinds of methods to make that possible. And in the end, I realized that I only had one option, which was to do it myself. It's bad, isn't it? See, because like in Buddhism, with these things, like we don't have like big institutes. Like, I mean, yes, of course, there are institutes in Buddhism. There are universities and these kinds of things in different countries. But they're not doing this work. We don't have a big institute for doing Pali translations. We should have, but we don't. We don't have, like, you know, big schools of learned scholars and all of these kinds of things. Yes, of course, there are the learned scholars and so on in different places, but they're not producing this work for whatever reason. So it's just up to ordinary people. And one of the things that I found, you know, one of the things that gave me confidence to do this work, like, I'm nobody, right? Who am I? I'm just a monk from Perth. You know, I grew up in Corbinia, right? What... That's my spiritual lineage, is Corbinia Primary School, right? What right do I have to translate the Buddha's words, right? But what I've learned over these past years working with Sutta Central is that the people who are doing this work are just people like you and I. Right? Most of the work that's been done translating Buddhist scriptures is just done by ordinary people. It's not done by professional scholars. It sometimes might be by monks or by nuns. Sometimes it might be by, you know, academics or linguists and qualified people, sometimes, but most of the time it's just done by volunteers and people who want to do it because of their love of the Dhamma. It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, you think about it. And so why is it that we put so little effort and little care and little thought into our sacred scriptures? Yeah? For 2,500 years, we've maintained the scriptures of incredible effort to pass them down to the present day, and it seems like we get to the present generation and we're content to just kind of put them in a cabinet, lock the door and leave them on the shrine and forget where the key is. You might think I'm joking, but many of you will know that I'm absolutely not joking, and this is actually what happens a lot of the time. So we think about these beautiful scriptures that we chant, like some of you before the meditation this evening would have been in here chanting and chanting the Metta Sutta in English, right? Yeah. So anyone here, we were chanting the Metta Sutta. You know the Metta Sutta we're chanting. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. So the Buddha's words on loving kindness is what it said, right? Of course, it isn't the Buddha's words on loving kindness. You know that, right? The Buddha didn't speak English. I'm just saying, okay? This is somebody else's words, right? So it's a translation of the Metta Sutta, which is in Pali, but it's a translation. Now, the Buddha encouraged us to do translation, okay? He said you should all learn the Dhamma in your own language, right? So there's nothing special about the Pali language, right? It's only special because we have to have our scriptures in that language. But Pali is just a language. It's just like any other language. But we translate it into modern English. And, of course, that process is quite a fraught one, isn't it? Because you're constantly coming up against choices, right? And you have to go one way or the other. What does this word mean? And words are funny little things, right? I mean, you can have some idea of what a word means, you know, just from looking in a dictionary or something like that. But you really want to get a sense for that, what that word means. It's quite hard. So one of the, it occurred to me towards the end of this project that translation was like murdering Schrodinger's cat over and over again. You know Schrodinger's cat? Yes? No? What? Thank you. Some people nodding their heads. Thank you. I appreciate the fact that there are some people of vaguely literate intelligence in the audience. But I did start out, however, saying that the Buddha's teaching was for fools. So thank you for confirming that. No, what? I'm only messing with you. Okay. So, but really, I'm not actually messing. I thought everyone knew what Schrodinger's cat. No, not everyone knew. Okay, so Schrodinger's cat. Schrodinger was a man, and he had a cat. No, that's not what it's about. It's not a real cat. And no cats were harmed in the course of this experiment, okay? Just calm down a little bit, all right? There's no cats were hurt. Actually, Schrodinger was a quantum physicist, and he came up with this theory of ambiguity, that in certain, when looked in a certain way, that a particle would behave like a wave, and a wave would behave like a particle. So you can't really say if it's a wave or a particle. It's almost like it will give you different answers depending on what kind of question that you give it. And so the Schrodinger's cat was a thought experiment to say, well, what if that particle was a cat and it was inside a box that was closed? So you wouldn't know if the cat was alive or dead, right? It's in an ambiguous state. And you couldn't say 100%. There's no valid answer to the question, is that cat alive or dead? It's just like a thought experiment. Until, of course, you open up the box and then you see the dead cat there. And you're like, did I kill it or not? And you can never answer that question. So this is what it struck me that translation is like. Like every word, every phrase that you're translating is like a big ball of ambiguity, right? A big ball of possibilities. Even ambiguity doesn't necessarily mean, because I don't necessarily mean that the meaning of things is ambiguous, because in the suttas, the meaning of things is usually pretty clear, right? But the way you can express that meaning right? You can express it in so many different ways. So you've got so many different possibilities, and then you just have to choose one. So you have to open up the lid and kill Schrodinger's cat and then put that down. And then you just have to keep doing that again and again and again and again, right? And so it's always a very unsatisfactory job, because you know that there's so much more possibility and potential in what you're translating, but you have to try to convey it in the best way that you can. And actually, Ajahn Brahmali gave me the most useful piece of advice in this, very simple piece of advice, but he said, one thing that we know about the Buddha's teachings, and I may be paraphrasing this, so if he's hearing this, then please can correct me, but this is my memory of the event, was that when we're translating, we often come to cases and things that we may be not entirely sure what it means. Right? But one thing that we know is that it means something. Right? We know that the Buddha wasn't an idiot. Right? When he spoke, he actually meant something. And it is very obvious from reading the suttas that the Buddha's purpose, his driving purpose, was to be clear. He wanted people to understand. He wanted people to understand. Now, of course, in a few cases, maybe that's not entirely true. Like in a few cases, he might make a riddle, right, whose meaning was unclear, and get people to try to solve it, right? So yes, you find that kind of thing and plays with words and these kinds of things from time to time. But for the most part, the Buddha was trying to be clear and was trying to express himself so that he could be understood. And so when we're translating, if we translate it in a way that's ambiguous or unclear, then we're definitely wrong. Right? Because that's not what the Buddha wanted. He wanted it to be clear. So we should at least translate it in a way that's clear and meaningful. And if we get it wrong, that's okay. You're allowed to make mistakes. And we can correct those mistakes and make it better later on. So this is that advice that Ajahn Brahmali gave me, and that was something that I always remembered, and that I always sort of brought to my translation. The other thing which really influenced what I was doing was I did a little bit of research before I did the translation, and I came to know that the largest English-speaking country in the world today is China. Did you know that? There are more people in China that speak English than in the US. I mean, England doesn't even count, right? That's just like a little blip in the ocean somewhere. That's just like a far-flung dialect of the English language is what's spoken in England, right? Mainstream English is Chinglish. Right? Mainstream English is Chinglish, and that's statistically. Now, maybe not in terms of the amount of people who speak it fluently or who speak it every day, right? Because a lot of people maybe speak it not that well. But still, it's a very interesting indication of those kinds of shifts. And when there are hundreds of millions of people in the world who speak English as a second language, right? Then we can't ignore them if we're writing in English, right? And so many of the characteristics of Chinglish and of English as what we call plain English or simple English are things that we can see in the Pali texts themselves. And sometimes when those texts have been translated, so whoever's phone that is, thank you so much for reminding us of impermanence and uncertainty. I appreciate that very greatly for that lesson. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, and so in many cases, translations have been done more in very kind of formal language, a very kind of technical language, often done translations done by linguists or by professors and people who are writing for this very kind of highfalutin language. And I had an interesting conversation when I was in Sri Lanka about this, talking about this with a monk. And we were discussing the translations, various different translations into Sinhala. And we were talking about the use of formalisms and formal pronouns. And when they translate into Sinhalese, then they use these very kind of elevated formal pronouns to refer to the Buddha. I think similar in Thai, they do a similar thing. And you know, I said, well, but of course, in Pali, they don't do that. In Pali, they just use simple pronouns. So the word they use to refer to the Buddha, they just say Bande. Right, the same they use for any other monk. There's no kind of special formal pronoun for the Buddha or term of address. And this monk said, yes, of course, you're right. Of course, the Pali is like that. It's very simple and very down to earth. But we can't translate it into Sinhala like that. We have to make it fancy. Right? So that was very interesting to hear that kind of approach. So, of course, as an Australian, I don't have that problem. So I can just do... We don't care about using fancy language in Australia. Right? So I could do a nice Australian translation, right? And okay, don't worry, right? It's not an ochre translation, okay? It's not like the Buddha said to the monks, "G'day, mates, how's it going?" I didn't do that. I think probably somebody should do that, but I didn't do that, okay? But I did try to bring that kind of ethos of, like, you know, trying to make it plain spoken, trying to make it direct, and try to make it something that anybody could understand without too much difficulty. Of course, you know, there's many things in the Dhamma that are hard to understand because they're subtle topics. They're difficult to understand, right? So it's not a matter of saying you have to sort of dumb everything down, but just a matter of saying don't make it harder than it needs to be. So these were some of the considerations that I had when I was going to do this translation. And so, of course, it's kind of a crazy thing, right, to go, because there's a million words that I wanted to translate, a million words in Pali, the four Nikayas that I just translated. It's a lot, right? If you started counting them, you'd just be there for ages, yeah? A million words. And in the past... when translators have done that, like Bhikkhu Bodhi done his excellent translations, and he usually took about a decade to translate one Nikaya, and so I did all four Nikayas in 2 years. So how did I do that? Sorry? How did I do that? Number one, be awesome. Okay? So that was my number one guideline. I'm going to have to be awesome if I do this. So that was what I kept reminding myself. Okay, just do it. Just live up to it. Like you've got like something that you want to aspire to, right? So you have to sort of lift. And it wasn't hard to do that because every day, I got to live like with the Buddha, my best friend, talking to me every day, right? And to listen to his words. I mean, what an incredible opportunity that was, right? But then the other thing, apart from being awesome, number two. To do anything, right, don't do anything else. Yeah? That's the key, yeah? To do anything, don't do anything else. And I was very lucky, again, to be in that stage of life where, you know, usually if somebody's at, you know, middle age like me and my hair's grey and all of this kind of thing, and usually people like that have things like responsibilities, you know, mortgages or families or monasteries to look after, these kinds of things. But I'm lucky because for my whole life, I've been completely irresponsible. And even if I've taken up responsibilities for a while, then I say, oh, okay, I'll just walk away and just leave it behind. And I try to do it in a somewhat sane kind of manner. But I am conscious of that, you know, in my life that as a monk, you know, I don't have stuff. I've got my bag. You can see my bag here. Can I show people this? You can? Thanks. Sorry, I'm a bit trapped by this stool thing. But I'm quite conscious that when I travel around, you know, when I came here, I'm going to Sydney on Monday, and all my possessions fit in this bag, right? That's it, right? So I'm more than 50 years old. And all my possessions fit into that bag, including my laptop. I made sure I got a bag that was big enough to put my laptop into it. The essential monk's requisites: bowl, three robes, laptop. So I like to show this to people. You know, I want to kind of show off or anything like that. But I just want to say this is the life we lead as monks. You know. This is what renunciation really means. And, of course, it goes without saying, I can only do that because of you guys, right? I can only do that because I know that tomorrow morning somebody will be along to offer breakfast, right? And because we're supported by so many people. and I can come to a place like this and I can stay the night. And there are so many generous and kind people who are going to help us. I know that. But for myself, as a renunciate, I just try to live as simply as I can. And so I was able to let go of all of those things and just go to the island, just take that bag with me and stay there 2.5 years and just do that one thing. As well as doing the translation, we were also building the website for it. We have developers and so on to do that. So I was kind of guiding that project as well. But that was the only things that I was doing. So for me, this was a, you know, obviously it's a labor of love, and it's it's something which it's bigger than anything I've done before, and probably bigger than anything I'll do for the rest of my life. And I do it just for that one simple reason that the world needs wisdom, and it needs some guidance, and it needs some Dhamma. And, you know, you can look out in the world and you see there's so much craziness there, right? There's so much materialism and so much stupidity and so much hate. Why? Why do we do these things? It's just crazy. And, you know, those of you who know me will know that I'm a monk who's been involved in, various kinds of social work and so on, as well as being a meditation monk and a teacher. But I've been involved in, trying to make the world a better place, I guess, which I can, if I can use my voice as a monk to do that on various kinds of issues, like especially climate change is one that I find very disturbing and very challenging for myself. And I look at this world that we're creating, and I look at how much people are investing in material things, and how blithely we seem to be just driving our economy and driving our choices further and further and creating more damage to the environment. And, you know, we live in a world that's so crazy now. People think that a sane solution to our problems is to settle on Mars. That's thinkable, right? That's a thinkable solution to our problems, is to colonize Mars, right? But to consume less, that's not thinkable. That's too hard. Colonizing Mars, yes, we can grapple with that as a problem, but getting people to actually buy less stuff and to create a world that doesn't depend on just buying more stuff over and over and over again, that's not even thinkable. Does anybody even have a possibility of how we're going to achieve this? And so I don't know, I don't have the answers to these things, but I know that these things were spoken of by the Buddha so many years ago, and that wisdom is there. The Buddha spoke about climate change 2,500 years ago. These things are not new. The Buddha spoke about climate change. The world is impermanent, the climate is impermanent. There will come a time when this planet is not livable by humans. It will become a desert. Yeah? The Buddha spoke about this, and he didn't just say that these things will happen as part of a natural cycle. He said that these things happen because of human greed. And that basic idea behind climate change, that human activity, farming, cutting down nature, damaging the environment, these things change the world that we live in. And this is a fundamental teaching of Buddhism, the teaching of interdependence, the teaching that who I am depends on who you are. The teaching that as we sit here in this room, right, the Buddha talked about the different elements, the four elements. Right? You think about the air element. Right? And you breathe in, when you meditate, you breathe in the air element. The external air becomes internal, becomes part of you, part of who you are. And that internal air that you have breathed in, you breathe out. It becomes part of the environment. Right? The environment is not something that's separate for us. This is not an abstract theory or philosophy. It's the reality that you are living with every breath. And with every breath, we are breathing in each other's air. Right? The air that you breathe in your next breath has molecules from all the different people in this room. That's kind of creepy, isn't it? when you think about it. But it's true, right? We like to think of ourselves as sealed off from the world, like our skin sort of separates us. But it doesn't really. It's just partially separates us. It's porous. So we are breathing in that air and breathing it out, right? And not to be a Debbie Downer or anything, but when you breathe in air, you take out the oxygen and you breathe out CO2. You are causing climate change. Right now, every time you breathe out, you are destroying the world. All right? Yeah? So what do you do? Well, breath meditation is good, because when you do breath meditation, your breath becomes very still. You breathe in less and breathe out less, okay? You're contributing less to climate change. The more that you do breath meditation, the less you're contributing to climate change, all right? So if you want a way to help, that's a really good way to help. Yeah. But these teachings that the Buddha gave are teachings about knowing who we are, knowing what are the choices that we make, knowing that our happiness doesn't depend on how much stuff we have, right? I mean, this is what the bumper sticker says, you know, whoever dies with most toys wins, right? And that's how we live. We can just build bigger houses and have more stuff, and that's winning. Right? But we know that isn't where true happiness comes from. You know that. Yeah? And even on a very simple level, we can see that actually real happiness comes from our family, our friends, the people around us, and community. Right? Of course, we need you know, physical enough, right? We need enough to eat. We need water, and there are plenty of people who don't have those things, and we need to help them to have that, enough of those things. But just having enough to eat and having something to drink and a place to sleep, that isn't happiness by itself. You know, here in Perth and in developed countries, most of us, we have enough of those things most of the time. That's not our problem. Our problem, we keep on wanting more. We're wanting more and more and more, and that's craving. And that whole thing that's driving our materialist society, it's just craving. It's just the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. Yeah? This is what the Buddha was pointing to again and again and again and again. Craving is what causes suffering. And that's kind of depressing. Why? Because, well, we've all got so much craving. Right? I remember once many years ago I saw a book, one of these kind of coffee table books, and it was called like The Great Thoughts of Mankind, something like that. And I said, oh, okay, I wonder what they've got from the Buddha. I wonder if the Buddha made it into The Great Thoughts of Mankind. So I opened it up to the entry of the Buddha, and it had the Buddha's two great thoughts were there is suffering and there is an origin of suffering. That's it. Two noble truths. So I was like, okay, that's kind of mediocre thoughts. That by itself doesn't qualify as great thoughts, but the Buddha actually had four noble truths. Suffering, that's what we live in. The origin of suffering is our craving. Right? The ending of suffering comes when we let go of craving. That is really empowering. Right? Just stop and think about that for a minute. You know, like these truths, these Buddhist truths that we hear so often. Sometimes we can become inured to them, we can forget, but this is what the Buddha was teaching again and again. We can let go of craving and think about what that means. It means you can want something, you can recognize that I want that thing, and then you can just let go of it and you'll be perfectly happy and you don't need to get that thing. And of course the most important part of the Buddha's teachings is the teaching that he taught again and again in the suttas is the Noble Eightfold Path. And he taught that there's a practical way to achieve that peace. And this is what's really crucial. And the other good news is the Eightfold Path makes sense. Okay? There's no kind of hidden mystical teaching, okay? There's no kind of woo-woo thing that we have to do, okay? We don't have to, like, sort of, you know, bow our heads to the sacred monkeys or anything like that, okay? It's just simple, straightforward things the Buddha taught. First of all, right view, right? So right view is nothing complicated about right view. Right view just means, how do we see the world? How do we look at the world, right? You're developing your right view simply by coming to this talk, right? By listening to Dhamma, reflecting on it, discussing it with your friends, right? That's how you develop right view, right thought or right intention, right? Loving kindness, yeah? Letting go, generosity. Yeah? Nothing, there's nothing mysterious about it and nothing too hard. It's something that you can try a little bit by little bit every day. You can try to be a little kinder. You can try to be a little bit more generous, right? You can try to be a little bit less greedy. And the more you try to do that, the more you reinforce those tendencies in your mind. So this is a very empowering teaching. I don't have to do it for you. Remember the Buddha said, he's only pointing the way. Right? You can do it. Right? Write speech. Again, very quite straightforward. Not necessarily, when I say these things are straightforward, I don't mean that they're easy to do, right? But you can understand them. You can understand why it's important. Why is it important? Write speech, to not lie, to not be aggressive and abuse people. You see, obviously this causes so much suffering, right? Right action, not killing, not stealing, sexual misconduct, avoiding sexual misconduct. Right livelihood. Right effort, right? Means making an effort in your practice, in your meditation. Right mindfulness, yeah? Being aware in the present, doing your meditation and so on. And right samadhi, is peace of mind, stillness of mind. So these are all of the factors of the Eightfold Path. And that's enough, right? You can go home after this and you never have to go to another Buddhist teaching again in your life if you want to. You can just practice that and that's good enough. You can come along to listen to talks if you enjoy it and it gives you inspiration and these kinds of things. But actually, that's what the teaching is. We recognize that we're in this world which is unsatisfactory, which is suffering, that we give rise to that suffering because of our own craving and attachments, that we can let go of those attachments, and the Eightfold Path is the path to be able to let go of that. And these are the Four Noble Truths, the truths that the Buddha spoke about again and again and again and again. And it's astonishing. I mean, just again, just pause and reflect and think about how incredible it is that a teaching so simple, so powerful, you know, was taught in India 2,500 years ago. And that was maintained for all that time through the incredible effort and devotion and faith of the Buddhist traditions. Right? Buddhist people, people like you and me, in Sri Lanka, in India, in Myanmar, in Thailand, in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in Tibet, in China, Japan, Korea, in all of these countries who gave a little or gave a lot to be able to preserve the Dhamma and bring it down for us. Yeah? And so that we can now see it. And for the first time, with the internet and through something like Sutta Central, we can present that across the world. And so we now have the Dhamma not just in English, but also we have it in more than 40 languages. And I mentioned before about the Metta Sutta, and we do listen to the Metta Sutta in translation and chant it in that beautiful translation. And a friend of ours in Sri Lanka, an Egyptian monk, has recently translated the Metta Sutta into Arabic. So this, I believe, is the first time that we've published an Arabic sutta in modern days. So that's, to me, that's very beautiful. And this is what we want to do, is to bring the Dhamma to more and more people in the world. And not just people. The most recent translation we published on Sutta Central was a translation of the Metta Sutta into Sindarin. I'm just looking for signs of recognition here. No, everyone's failed the Tolkien geek test. Sindarin is the language of the elves in The Lord of the Rings. I mean, see, first Schrodinger's cat and now elven languages. I mean, seriously? So the language of the elves in The Lord of the Rings is Sindarin, and we now have the Metta Sutta in Sindarin. So any elves among you, you can read it in your native tongue. So that's very beautiful. We're looking for somebody to do a Klingon translation next. If anybody knows Klingon, then just get in touch with us. I mean, those Klingons, they really need some bit of metta, yeah. So this is good. Anyway, so if you want to read it in Sindarin, you can go to Sutta Central and read it there in Sindarin. Or in English as well, also. So this is what we want to do, is to bring these teachings, and for the first time we can take them all around the world. And so That's what I wanted to say for now on what we've been doing and our work with Sutta Central and the meaning of it. And I just wanted to once more just express my gratitude to the Buddhist Society for supporting me through the years, and for also many people within the Buddhist Society have contributed to Sutta Central, so I give you my thanks for that. And we have worked hard, and there's been a strong team of volunteers and supporters and workers around the world who have really done some amazing work, and so I'm very proud of what we've done. And so hopefully that if you're interested to follow up and to learn something about the Buddha's words, then please have a look at Sutta Central and see what the Buddha was teaching all of those years ago. Okay, so that's my talk for this evening. And I believe now we have time for some questions. Is that right? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Priya.
Ajahn, could you also explain where to next, your idea of what happens next now that you have translated to English, simple English, as well as many other...
Sorry, Prem, can you
speak
a
little bit? Many other languages, what is next?
What is next?
Yeah.
Next is what comes after this. I'm sorry, Prem. I couldn't resist. So for Sutta Central, so what we've done is we've set it up to support further translations. So translations into third languages. So we have the Pali in English, and then translations into different languages. So Indonesian, Finnish, Swahili, and so on. So we're going to support a new generation of translations in those different languages. So this is one of the things we'll be focusing on in the coming months. Yeah. So if anybody's interested to help out with that, then please get in touch with us. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you need a dictionary? Come. Speak. Ask your question, please. Into the microphone.
I just wanted to know how you actually did do the translation. So you're only one lingual speaking, so you're only English speaking. So how do you actually do the translation?
Oh, no, I know Pali.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, no. Well, I still use dictionaries, but I learnt Pali when I was a young monk. And so I've known Pali for the last 20 years or so, and have done a lot of work in the field and a lot of translations and taught Pali classes and all of those kinds of things. No, sure, of course. Yeah. So, and I mean, Pali, of course, you know, people think of it as a very kind of obscure thing. It's like very kind of mysterious because it's a 2,500-year-old sacred language of India. But in fact, one of the great advantages that we have is that Pali and the ancient Indic languages were studied and were analysed using an incredible linguistic science. And about 100 years ago, after the Buddha, in about 400 BC, there was an Indian grammarian called Panini who made a treatise on Sanskrit, which is one of the most incredible works of the human mind of all time in any field. And Panini's grammar was by far the most advanced work in linguistics of any kind up until the 20th century. And he established the science of understanding those languages, especially Sanskrit and Pali, closely related languages, which was then taken up by the Pali scholars and commentators and so on and so forth. So even though the languages are so ancient, because they were so well studied and well understood, we actually have a very good understanding of them. So they're not like... they're not really kind of obscure languages. Actually, Pali is actually very clear. And of course, there are obscurities and there are difficulties. But on the whole, it's a very well understood language. And the study of Pali has been maintained also as a living tradition through the Theravada tradition. So it's quite a normal thing, especially for monks and nuns, but also for lay people. I think in the old days in Sri Lanka, you'd always learn some Pali at school. Do they do it today still, I think? Not sure if they still do it today, but certainly that was the normal thing that you'd learn the basics of Pali while still at school. So that the thing with translation is that the 10% of the work is your source language. Understanding Pali is 10% of the work. Expressing it in English is 90% of the work. Yeah, that's the hard part. Yeah. To learn Pali, I learned it over a few years. I memorized a lot of Pali texts and Pali suttas, and then studied the grammars and so on as well. So, a few years. Yeah. So I'm still learning, yeah. Yeah, please.
I want to ask about the reincarnation.
Yeah.
So if we, when you reincarnate, do you have a purpose?
Okay.
Do you have a purpose or a mission or something? And if you do, how is kind of possible to know which is the purpose?
Okay.
Or which is the mission?
Okay. All right, interesting question. So the question is, when you become reincarnated, do you have a mission or a purpose, and do you know that? I think probably sometimes and sometimes not. I mean, reincarnation from a Buddhist perspective is not a mysterious process, okay? It's a continuation of your consciousness from one life to the next. And so that process is much like your life. And in your life, sometimes you can have a purpose, and sometimes not, right? Sometimes you can know what that purpose is, and sometimes not. And sometimes we're lost, and sometimes we know that there is a purpose, but we don't know what it is. Or sometimes we're mistaken about what it is. And this is ignorance. And so the Buddha said that we were being reborn because we have ignorance, because we don't have really clarity about what our life is. So, yes, certainly in some cases, you know, the people might have a very kind of clear purpose when they are reborn or reincarnated in a particular life, and they might be able to understand what that is, you know. But that's not necessarily going to be the case for everyone. Just like not everybody in this room has that sense of purpose. But purpose can be something that we can create, right? So when we say, well, like we have a purpose, all that means is that we've created that sense of purpose and that sense of meaning in the past, right? But even if we don't have that now, we can find one. Right? So we can find a sense of purpose. We don't have to be given it by anybody else. Yeah. Go on.
So, if you are a good person, supposedly you're a kind of good person, and
I don't
get
know.
A lot of shit back.
Sorry, I don't know.
All
Go
the
on.
Time,
hypothetically.
If you get a lot of shit back.
Uh-huh.
That's something related with your karma, probably.
Maybe. Okay. I'd rather not make any assumptions about that.
Yeah, seriously, it's something that I am interested in knowing. How can it be possible that someone can behave well, can be a good person, can do a lot of good things,
uh-huh.
and getting just shit back and back.
Yeah, yeah.
All the time say hello.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that karma too clear or?
Okay. So, yeah, again, very good question. And so the question of how can you be, you know, good people and some bad things happen to you, and sometimes bad people and lots of good things happen to you, right? And does anybody remember? This is probably a generational question, but does anybody remember Tim and Debbie? Australia is standing in it? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Okay. And I remember Tim and Debbie, Brain Space, right? They had this get Brain Space. And I remember one of them that they were talking, and Debbie, this is a comedy thing, and Debbie was saying, oh, you know, when you're rich, you know, you might seem like a bit happy, but you're not really happy. Right? And Tim was like, well, I passed this guy on the way here driving this really big Mercedes, and he looked pretty happy. He wasn't really happy. And Tim was like, well, I don't know. He had this big boat behind him, and he was smiling, and he looked really happy. Debbie's like, no, he's not really happy. He just seems happy. He's just pretending to be happy. But this is it. Life is complicated, right? And that's really the best answer that you can have, is life is complicated. People do good. People do mixes of good and bad things all the time, right? And so the thing about karma, right, is that karma doesn't determine everything, okay? Karma is just one thing among many, right? And so the world isn't suddenly just magically determined into place by karma. I mean, just you think about it, right? You know, some of the people here have iPhones, right? Right? So people have iPhones, right? Do you have an iPhone because of your past karma? Right? I mean, was it the case that suddenly, like 20 years ago, people started doing iPhone having karma, right? And then they got reborn this life, and suddenly, bingo, there are iPhones everywhere, right? And sort of mysteriously, no one for the past 2,000 years has ever done iPhone having karma, so then that's why there weren't any iPhones, right? I mean, it's crazy when you think about it. Of course not. The reason people have iPhones has nothing to do with karma. It has to do with technology, with economic development, and all of those kinds of things. So these are things that are independent of your karma and your choices, right? And so karma is one of those things which will influence your life and influence your choices, right? And one of those, allow me to rephrase. The choices that we make are one of those things that will influence the outcomes that we have in our life. But the choices that we make, that is to say, the karma that we make, right? Karma means choice, right? So the choices that we make don't operate independently, and there are many other factors at play. So first of all, we have to consider that if reincarnation is true, then we have made many, many different kinds of karma, many different kinds of choices for so many past lives. So we don't know what the results of that might be. Right? We also don't know what other kinds of factors are affecting us. Right? All we can really know is that if we make good choices now, then this is going to lead to happiness. If we make bad choices, it will lead to suffering. That's what we can know. So that's what we have to focus on. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
One thing. Did they use Pali to teach right at the beginning, or it was subsequently translated?
Okay. So the question was, did the Buddha speak in Pali, or were the texts translated? So this is a question which comes up a lot, and it's a little bit of a slightly misleading question because not a misleading question, but just when we're thinking about it. See, in Indian languages are written down phonetically, right? That means that each sound in the language is represented very accurately and very precisely in the alphabet. So if you write down, say, the language we know as Pali, next to the language that, for example, of the Ashokan inscriptions, which we call Magadhi, which is a little bit different from Pali. And you'll see that there's some spelling variations. But actually, you know, imagine that if you had someone from Australia and someone from Scotland, and you were to phonetically write down exactly what they were saying. Of course, you'd see differences between them and some different vocabulary and these kinds of things. But it's just a dialect. It's just a different accent, right? So Pali itself, there's been recent studies on that seem to establish quite strongly that Pali itself was a language current in South India, mid to South India, maybe a couple of hundred years after the time of the Buddha. There's a lot of inscriptions from that region which are in Pali or something very close to it. So that was the kind of the dialect of that region. So the Buddha spoke a language or a dialect that was very closely related to that, and it was kind of standardized into that particular form. Personally, I believe that the Buddha would have spoken a number of different dialects, and this is just from my experience living in Thailand, and also even more so in Malaysia, that monks will regularly give teachings in different languages and different dialects depending on the region. And I've been in a room with a monk in Malaysia where he's giving a Dhamma talk, and before he gives the Dhamma talk, he's like, say, how many people speak Hokkien? How many people speak Cantonese? How many people speak Hakka? How many people speak English? How many Bahasa? And then, okay, so tonight's talk's in Hokkien, so then he gives the talk in Hokkien. In Thailand also, they will give talks sometimes in the northeast dialect. If you're in northeast Thailand, it's like a Lao dialect. Sometimes in central Thai, sometimes it's kind of a mix between the two, depending on who's in the audience. So I think that the Buddha, as he travelled, would have probably spoken in, you know, adjusted his local dialect depending on the area. I mean, to be honest, we all do that all the time anyway, right? I mean, if I'm an Australian, you know, if I'm talking to other Australians, then I'll have more of an Australian accent, right? And so it's just natural. So I think the Buddha's own dialect would have varied to some degree, but later on it became standardized in a particular form. And so the form that we have is in the Pali language. But the important thing to know is that it doesn't really affect anything, right? It's just like the details of pronunciation and so on, but the actual words are the same and have the same meaning. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah. Please. Yes, so definitely translating the meaning of a sentence rather than the individual words, yeah. Again, this is something I think that translators know, that meaning doesn't lie in words so much as in sentences or utterances and phrases. So, you know, we try to express it as well as we can. And to me, a literal translation, if I translate literally, like word by word, then that's a failure. That's because I haven't understood it well enough. So if I feel like I don't understand the sentence well enough, sometimes I'll fall back to a literal translation. But really, the best way is to understand what the meaning of the word, the meaning of the phrase is, and express it. Yeah. Yeah.
Some years ago, I read a book that was talking about the differences between the Abrahamic faiths and the Dharmic religions. And one of the aspects in that book that he spoke about was the nature of Sanskrit and how a lot of the words that are in the Sanskrit language that we think we know in English aren't actually what we think we know, and how that affects people's understanding of things. So when it comes to translating the suttas, how do you, and the same sort of thing would apply in Pali, because, I mean, you mentioned Samadhi, for instance, in your talk, how do you render it into English, or do you just leave it untranslated? And if you do leave it untranslated, how do you get the sense of what that word is about across?
Okay, so another good question. So the answer is no, I don't leave it untranslated, and in fact, compared to previous translations, it's much more complete, and I have left virtually no words untranslated in the text. Only a few things like proper names and things like that. It really comes back to what I mentioned before about what Ajahn Brahmani said. He said we're not always 100% sure what it means, but we have to make some kind of decision about it. Now, if we leave words untranslated, then the problem is that creates the illusion that we have maintained the meaning. I think it's actually a bad practice for translators to leave words untranslated. It's a translation. You should translate it. And that shouldn't even be a question. The problem is that, take a simple example. Say the word bodhisattva. So this is a good word to use because it's a word that's quite well known in English, right? People know what bodhisattva is. You can Google it. Google will tell you. Bodhisattva means somebody who sets aside their own welfare for the sake of all sentient beings. Right? That's what bodhisattva means, right? But of course, the word bodhisattva appears in the Pali canon, but it has a completely different meaning. And in the Pali canon, it means almost exactly the opposite. And the word bodhisattva in the Pali canon is precisely used for the Buddha when he leaves behind his family and goes out to seek awakening. Right? So if we leave that word untranslated, yeah, you're actually, first of all, you're conveying the impression that somebody will read that and they'll know, oh, I know what a bodhisattva is, right? So you're conveying the impression that you've maintained the meaning by keeping the word the same. But in fact, you're conveying the exact opposite meaning. Right? So what bodhisattva means in the Pali canon is one who is intent upon awakening. And that's how I translated it. And so in almost all cases, I do that. Another good example we were talking about today is the word bhikkhu. In some translations, the word bhikkhu is left untranslated. And bhikkhu, of course, meaning a monk. But the problem with leaving it untranslated, like in modern day Sri Lanka, they will often translate bhikkhu as priest. Yeah? And that's actually not a bad translation, because in Sri Lankan culture, bhikkhus often perform priestly duties, and they perform sort of pastoral duties, and they're living in the village, and they look after people and so on, in ways that are quite similar to what, say, a Christian priest might do, right? But the word bhikkhu doesn't mean priest. It means mendicant. It means someone who's seeking alms. And in many Buddhist cultures today, bhikkhus don't do that anymore. They don't have an alms culture. Yeah? In some countries they do, other countries they don't. So we're, by leaving it untranslated, we're hiding what the actual meaning of that is. Bhikkhu doesn't mean priest. It means mendicant, Right? That's what the word actually means, is mendicant, somebody who relies on alms for their sustenance. And so again, I translated that as mendicant to try to convey that kind of sense of the original meaning. Yeah. So it looks like a lot of people are... we're leaving. But anyway, we have... This is my passion. I'll talk about this all night, so I don't care. Go on. Yes, please.
So you've mentioned climate change before and that you're quite interested in that topic. Myself, I'm quite interested too, quite fascinated, as well as it's quite confronting, especially knowing that this fast-moving world will not stop consuming so much. So I've been trying to figure out how I can basically keep my sanity in just knowing that we're racing against the wall.
Yeah.
Against the wall. And what can we do as individuals to save our sanity?
To save our sanity or save our planet?
Well, I think the planet, I think the turning points have been already in the past, and there are minor turning points we can do or minor things we can do right now. This is my opinion and the research I've done so far. And so it's basically just about living it out. And I, myself and my partner, we live very simply. And we're basically just about to drop everything and go traveling and just say, you know what, this life is for us. And not for the demanding society.
Yeah. No, that sounds beautiful. I asked that question about saving yourself or saving the planet because I think this is one of the things that I've grappled with. Like, because I've been involved in the environmental movement since about 1985. Okay, and I was just remembering that the other day. I helped organise my first environmental conference in 1985, and we had a panel on vegetarianism. And I was remembering that I invited the Aboriginal elder Ken Colbung to come along and present on that, and he was a vegetarian. And so that was all those years ago. And a lot of the things that we're talking about now, climate change and, you know, the swine flu and factory farming and antibiotic resistance and all of this stuff we were talking about in those days, all exactly the same. And, you know, it's what we were saying in those times, that all of these things are going to be happening. And now they are actually happening. And one of the things that I've noticed over the years is that a part of that conversation always has to be, but there's still time, and here's what you have to do. It's like there's this compulsion. Like, we have to be able to say there's something that you can do. But what if there isn't? Right? What if there isn't time? What if there's actually really nothing that we can do? Right? I mean, of course there are things we can do in terms of reducing our own consumption and so on, but that's not going to solve the problem. Right? And when you come face to face with that, that's when you start to really sort of contemplate. It's one thing to think about impermanence and the planet changes. Another thing to think about, we're wrecking it because we're so stupid and greedy. And that's what's so painful about it. Nothing about this is inevitable at all. Right? Humans have lived on this planet for thousands and thousands of years. We don't have to destroy the environment if we don't want to. We only do it because we choose to. And that's what's really painful and really hard to grapple. So that's something that I don't have any answers for you, but just to acknowledge that fact, that we're going to have to come to grips with that space that says, maybe we can't do anything. What do we do then? How do we live?
We can plant a tree.
Can plant a tree and we can live. Yeah. And we can try to love each other and try to live the best life we can for the time we have remaining. Yeah?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, we have questions from overseas, do we? All right. Thank you so much. Okay, so our dear friends from across the waters. So Ajahn Brahm said that well, you know, not to take Kantaram Ram seriously, but he threatened that he would be writing in disguised questions for me to tonight, but I don't know whether he really has. Okay, so from Pleats USA, how can Buddhism help a person who has OCD, and what can that person do to control it? Well, look, if for somebody who has OCD, I'm not an expert, and I wouldn't necessarily presume to be able to say that there's anything in Buddhism to do that, but the first thing that I would do would be to say, look, you know, if you are somebody who has OCD, or indeed any kind of psychological problem or personality disorder or whatever it might be, then if you want to try to use Buddhist approaches, then do it with some guidance. Okay, Buddhism wasn't meant as a mental health care. That's not what the purpose. It's a spiritual path. So yes, of course, there are many things that are found in Buddhism that can be helpful. But don't somehow expect that spiritual path is going to automatically translate to being mental health care for that specific condition that you have, okay? So that specific condition that you have is also part of who you are as a person, right? So it's not something that you can sort of universally prescribe. So when I'm speaking, and this happens to me a lot, and I have helped to put together and run courses on Buddhism and psychotherapy and talking about lots of different kind of conditions and approaches and these kinds of things. And the first thing that I would say is that you need to talk in detail and closely with somebody who has experience with that particular condition, who can also listen to who you are as a person and can work with you in what practices might be useful. Maybe mindfulness practices would be useful, maybe meditation would be useful, but I would really urge you, if at all possible, to work closely together with somebody who has some experience and can help to guide you on that path, because otherwise it's easy to get lost or to get frustrated and to not, and if you don't really understand what these practices are for. Okay, so the question here from Waikit in Malaysia, I was wondering about the differences between Theravadan and Mahayana scriptures. Is it really different or generally the same thing in different language? So in Buddhism, of course, there are sort of two great branches or schools of Buddhism, the Theravada school in the south of Asia and the Mahayana school generally in the north of Asia. And so the question is, are the scriptures really the same or different? And the answer is yes. They are both the same and different, okay? Because scripture is very big. Some parts of them are the same and other parts of them are different, okay? So those scriptures that I've been talking about, the four Nikayas and the Pali Suttas, these ones are found in very, very similar form in the Chinese canon, and also significant parts of them also in Tibetan and so on. So these are something which is shared among all of the traditions and which all of the different traditions hark back to. But in addition to that, each of the traditions has its own literature, which is sort of unique to that particular tradition. And so in the Mahayana schools, they have the Mahayana Sutras and many different treaties and so on. And in Theravadan, they have the Abhidhamma and other treaties like Visuddhimagga and commentaries and these kinds of things. So there are some which are the same and then others which are different. But all of those scriptures which are different, remember, these are things which build on the teachings found in the early suttas. Okay? So even if you look at the great Mahayana masters, like Asanga, Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, then they were all extremely well versed in the early suttas, and they refer to them frequently, and they clearly were very deeply learned in the teachings found in the early suttas. So these are the foundations upon which all of the later literature of the traditions is being built. So if you want to understand that later literature, you have to understand the suttas first. Anyway, next one, from Vienna. Hello, Vienna, how are you going? Okay, why is it that there is such a thing as a holy scripture in Buddhism if we are supposed to realize all the truths ourselves? It seems to me more like a burden. I am so sorry. I don't want to make a burden for you. If it's a burden, then put it down and be happy. Okay? So don't think of it as a burden. Think of it as a good friend. Okay? The Buddha just wanted to help you ease your suffering. That's all. So according to Buddhism and the Buddhist theory, that there are two causes for the arising of right view and right understanding. Number one is the voice of another, and number two is one's own inner reflection. So the listening to the voice of another, the wise words of another, this is not something that should be a burden for you. It's something which should be a joy for you. It should be a joy to know that there are these teachings which come from the truth. Of course, we are meant to, that truth is not, it's not like a final truth or an ultimate truth. It's a guide. It's pointing us in that right direction. You know, when I was thinking about doing translation, it occurred to me that there are two different kinds of translation that you can do, right? So, of two different kinds of text. So one might be like translating Shakespeare, and the other one is like translating washing machine instructions. Okay? Now, if I'm translating Shakespeare, I have to capture the poetry of it, right? I have to capture the wordplay, the flavour of it, yeah? And so it's about creating that experience where when you listen to it, you laugh at the right bits, that you're moved with the right bits and all of those things, and there's a quality of aesthetic joy and beauty which comes simply from that translation. Now, if I'm translating washing machine instructions, I don't care about any of those things. All I care about is, can somebody actually use the washing machine, right? And whether it's a literal translation, whether you get every detail right and all of that doesn't matter. What matters is, can someone read that and work the washing machine? Right? And translating the Buddha suttas is more like washing machine instructions than it is like Shakespeare. Right? I'm not saying it's entirely devoid of those literary qualities and so on, but I'm saying the main point of the Buddha suttas is to get you to practice. It's to get you to let go of suffering. And as long as you can let go of suffering, that's the point. Yeah? You end up with a clean clothes, right? Or a clean mind. That's what the Buddha suttas is about. Right? So don't think of them as being something that's a burden. Think of it something as a good friend who you can cultivate and get to know, and who can be there for you in times of trouble, who can give you wise words when you're confused, and who can be solace for you when you're experiencing loss. And when we think about it in that way, then it shouldn't be a burden for us. Okay. So I think that's all we have time for this evening. If you want to hear some more about the suttas, I'll be going into a bit more detail on Sunday during the sutta class. So you're most welcome to come for that. And meanwhile, I think we should finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.
No.